Alaska is a high cost of operation for us, and then recently there have been additional taxes and regulations layered onto our operation.
Two more cruise ships pull their business out of Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 10th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a powerful idea Aniak residents want to share with the rest of the country.
Think about kids helping people in their community, taking on responsibility for the fact that I live here too.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
State Department of Revenue Commissioner Patrick Galvin today released the revenue forecast for 2010 and 2011. Galvin said 2009 was a wild ride for oil prices, from highs above $130 per barrel last spring to 5 months later, when he says prices suffered the largest decline in history as they fell into the 20s.
At this time last year, I was talking about how humbling it was to be a prognosticator of oil prices. This year, we have experienced a relative period of stability. During fiscal year 2010, oil prices have hovered generally between $60 and $80 per barrel, averaging just over $70 a barrel this year.
Galvin says this stability is expected to continue with a slight drop over the course of the remaining year and then rising gradually in future years. He says the current forecast for 2010 is $67 per barrel, representing an increase from the spring prediction of $58. That is having a big impact on the state's unrestricted revenue.
Our current forecast for FY 2010 unrestricted revenue is $4.8 billion. This represents a significant increase from our spring forecast, which was $3.2 billion.
Galvin says the prediction for 2011 is for oil to average $76 a barrel, which will result in unrestricted revenue of $5.2 billion. He says North Slope production continues its two-decade decline. Production dropped more than 3% from 2008 to 2009. Galvin says future decline is expected for 2011, but then things begin a brief turnaround.
We actually see production increases expected in FY 2013 and FY 2014, which results in production in 2014, which is actually above what we're forecasting for 2011. And then 2015 would see declines beyond that.
Galvin says the uptick in production is because new fields will be coming online. The full report is available online. Links are at our website, aprn.org. Two more cruise ships will stop sailing to Alaska in the summer of 2011. That's in addition to the three that will stop in the coming season, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The cruise ships Royal Princess and Rheindam will shift to Europe and other parts of the world for the 2011 summer season. The Royal carries about 700 passengers, and the Rheindam, a Holland America ship, has a capacity of around 1,300. The lines will remain mainstays of Alaska tourism. Princess will still send six ships to the state, and Holland America will send seven. Bruce Bustamante of Princess Cruises says vessels are being redeployed because the state is too expensive.
Alaska is a high cost of operation for us, and then recently there have been additional taxes and regulations layered onto our operation, so it's reduced the return on investment, you know, for these assets, and that's what cruise ships are. They're mobile assets.
Holland America did not immediately respond to an interview request. Princess Carnival and Royal Caribbean have already shifted Alaska ships to Eastern and other markets for the 2010 season. Tour officials estimate total passenger capacity will drop about 15%. Ron Peck of the Alaska Travel Industry Association says the cruise ship initiative, passed by voters in 2006, is to blame.
A lot of people say, well, it's because of the economy or it's because of this factor, and I would say it's a combination of things. But you cannot deny that when you layer additional costs on a specific business sector to the tune of $75 million since the ballot initiative was passed, that they're going to look where they can deploy their assets to do the best they can for their business.
The two ships leaving in 2011 will be somewhat offset by the addition of two other vessels. The 900-passenger Crystal Symphony will begin sailing, as will the 2,400-capacity Disney Wonder. Changes in the next two seasons' itineraries will affect some communities more than others. Alaska Alliance for Cruise Travel spokesman John Litton, owner of Sitka Tours, says reductions at his port town will hit excursion operators hard.
Your costs don't drop just because the ships go away. So I can't pick up and move to another community. I certainly can't take my equipment down to the Caribbean where they're operating. I'm sunk, and that's how I'm feeling, as well as virtually hundreds of other small business people around the state.
Princess and Holland America are part of Carnival Corporation, which owns 10 cruise lines worldwide. Carnival officials have called for repeal or reduction of fees and regulations created by the cruise ship initiative. Ballot measure author Joe Geldof says head taxes and discharge limitations are not causing ships to move.
I think it has everything to do with margins, other business opportunities, changing demographics, and frankly, the way people are cruising in many markets. They are shorter tours, they are closer to home, and if you can work out of a place into the Baltic, into the Mediterranean, into the Atlantic, that's what you're going to do.
Cruise lines kept passenger levels up last season by deeply discounting ticket prices. It's not clear whether fewer ships and a recovering economy will make that necessary in the upcoming season. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The head of the Federal Aviation Administration says he expects Alaska's flight service stations to stay under the FAA's oversight. The stations provide pilots with up-to-date weather and safety information and can communicate with planes while they're in flight. Alaska is the only state where the flight service stations are run by the FAA and not contracted out. FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt testified today before the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee, of which Senator Begich is a member. Begich asked about the future of the service centers.
We think they do a great job. Our concern, and my concern, is that there are vacancies occurring. The training is not occurring to replace those people. And what I'm starting to hear is that folks are concerned that it's basically FAA is letting it kind of peter out so then they can have an excuse to contract out. And that concerns me.
In recent years, other flight service stations throughout the country have been contracted out to Lockheed Martin. But Babbitt assured the senator that he expects Alaska's flight service centers to be fully staffed and stay under FAA control.
I don't have the full details, but I will get back with you and your office to make sure that we have the staffing levels that are required up there. And I have no intent of making any change in that environment, so that I think I can assuage that fear for you.
Babbitt says a new federal ruling should allow workers approaching retirement age to stay on the job a little longer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a lower 48 adventurer plans an epic trip across the state.
I'm walking into this trip with a great deal of humility and respect for the land of Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released their draft catch share policy today. The policy encourages fishery management councils around the country to adopt catch share programs like the ones already in place for the Bering Sea crab and pollock fisheries, where the total allowable catch is divided into shares.
What this new policy is doing is urging every council to actively consider catch shares for different fisheries.
NOAA Administrator Dr. Jane Lubchenco spoke with reporters over a teleconference today. She says that worldwide studies have shown that catch share programs help rebuild ailing fisheries better than traditional management systems. They can also increase the value of the catch. NOAA estimates that catch shares can increase the dockside value of seafood by $2.2 billion. NOAA is giving a set of guidelines on how to set up the programs, but each regional fishery council will tailor the catch share programs to their specific fisheries.
The devil is in the design, and the benefit is in the design. And the point is that it's important to get the design right, which is why we're spending a fair amount of time thinking about what should the guidance to the councils be, what are the best lessons learned, how can they be designed to have the best possible outcomes for fish and for fishermen, as well as the health of oceans.
Though catch share programs may raise the overall value of a fishery, they can also cause many people to lose their jobs. For example, crab rationalization in the Bering Sea led the fleet size to drop from 250 boats to 70, meaning many crew members lost their positions. Lubchenco says catch shares lead to fewer jobs, but better jobs, and help to stabilize local economies.
The purpose of catch shares is to help put those fisheries that are appropriate for catch share management on a better path to sustainability. And in some cases, that's going to mean fewer boats or fewer fishing jobs simply because there has been too much in the past. The goal is not to sustain the level of fishing that's happening now. The goal is to transition to a level that can be sustained and healthy through time.
She says the programs also make it beneficial for fishermen to help protect the resources. The draft catch share policy will be open for public comments until April 10th. 13 fisheries in the U.S. currently use catch share programs. 6 of those are in Alaska. A just-released study of the recent influx of in-state transfer students to Anchorage contains some surprising results, along with daunting challenges for the school district and the city. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In the fall of 2008, enrollment in Anchorage public schools surpassed district predictions by about 500 students. The district, along with the city, described the likely cause as Bush families seeking to escape the growing economic woes spreading throughout rural communities. A new report from the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research says that description is only partially true. Anthropologist Marie Lowe oversaw the research project entitled New Students in the Anchorage School District, Where Are They From? She says that 2007 and 2008 student records from the district show that the majority of the in-state transfers, over 55%, came to Anchorage from road system areas, and the majority of those, nearly 275 students, were from the Matsu borough. Lowe says the dominance of Matsu transfers makes sense.
Proximity plays a role in our story here. It's a lot easier for people to move from the Matsu than the North Slope. And also, I think it's in proportion to the populations in these places.
Of the on-road areas, Fairbanks was second and the Kenai Peninsula third. From the off-road regions, Southwest Alaska, with Bethel as a hub, was first. Almost every school district in the state saw students move to Anchorage. Lowe says the Matsu experience is summarized best by one of the survey's direct quotations.
the Mat-Su resident said, we moved because we both work in Anchorage, and with high gas prices, it was costing a lot to commute. My husband and I are both medical professionals with very steady jobs. We feel our son has better educational opportunities in Anchorage. And I think that that captured what we were hearing from many of the Mat-Su residents who moved.
Reduced living expenses, better employment opportunities, and broader educational offerings were the three main reasons families with children came to Anchorage. With the school district's cooperation, the researchers identified 881 transfer students from just over 790 families. Lowe and her staff sent out 681 surveys, about 350 came back, and were acceptable for the study. The surveys revealed another hole in the rural family migration assumption.
What we found out was that the students were moving alone.
Of a little more than 400 students, slightly over 40% moved while their families did not. More than a third, mostly Alaska Native, went to relatives already living in Anchorage. Other situations involved in-district transfers, previously homeschool students, and changes in custody arrangements. Lowe says the transfer experience for students coming from bush communities, with or without families, often does not go smoothly.
Students are moving back and forth. The term migration doesn't really capture sort of a dual existence that many students and their families are living in both rural Alaska and urban.
The study shows, through statistics and personal responses, just how difficult it can be for these students and their families. For the students, broader educational opportunities often come with frightening large schools and classes, a feeling of no support, and a cultural divorce from their village life. Older students can have a tougher time than younger ones. Adjustment often involves the entire family. Many rural families suggested a need for orientation assistance on urban skills, ranging from seeking employment to using public transportation. And about 20% of both the on-road and off-road families shared a common difficulty.
One thing that the study does illuminate is the housing crunch in Anchorage and the challenges that places on new families here. And we had several respondents who were living in motels and finding it difficult to get permanent and adequate housing here. So that's an important point for the municipality anyway.
The complete study, New Students in the Anchorage School District, Where Are They From?, is posted on the Institute of Social and Economic Research website. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The village of Aniak is in mourning. In October, the Kuskokwim River community lost its volunteer fire chief, Pete Brown, who died of cancer. Brown was a force for pulling people in the village together for good. Now Aniak residents are hoping to honor his legacy by taking one program he started to other communities across the nation. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Last month, Aniak's community center caught fire. In the morning cold, a group of teenage girls responded. They helped save the structure from burning to the ground. As they worked the fire hose lines, the girls had extensive training to draw on, thanks to Pete Brown, the late fire chief. Brown's close friend in town, Gwendolyn Brock, still marvels at what they accomplished.
They were there alongside with the adults, helping to put out the fire. You know, and I think we just don't realize what he did. I think we think we do, but we really don't.
P. Pete Brown started the Dragon Slayers, a group of teenagers in Aniak who are trained to respond to emergency medical calls and fires. He got the group going in the early 1990s when his own son was hit by an ATV and badly injured. His son recovered, but Brown couldn't believe how long it had taken to get help. He decided to take matters into his own hands. Thomas Brock is Aniak's mayor and served alongside Brown as the assistant fire chief in town.
You could say he was the ultimate volunteer. I mean, his service to this community was truly selfless. Not only to, you know, our local community here, but, you know, he really, really inspired people from around the world.
The Aniak Dragon Slayers have been featured on Oprah, in People magazine, and in USA Today. A major motion picture was in the works, but never panned out. Gwendolyn Brock has lived in the community for 3 decades. She wonders if people even remember what it was like before Pete Brown revitalized the fire department.
And yeah, we had a volunteer fire department, but they had this old clunker of a fire truck where the water froze half the time. So they get ready to go to put out a fire, and they... nothing would come out of the holes. And so, I mean, it's not funny, but then all it could do was stand there and watch stuff burn. It was like, okay, guys, let's put out the fire. You know, so it's like, oh my God. So Pete came along and, you know, saw that the community needed to be about people helping people.
Pete Brown was a Vietnam War vet and a poetry lover who arrived in Alaska in the 1970s and lived for years with his family in a remote cabin miles from Aniak. In the village, he worked for the troopers for a while and held other jobs around the community over the years. But his life was devoted to helping kids. Dave Lemaster is a former teacher who worked closely with Brown. He says he's never seen anyone as good with kids as Pete Brown was.
They sense genuine love, and he genuinely loved kids and young people and teenagers. And they could feel that, even though he'd be real gruff and yell at them and get moving type of thing. And they just responded.
Lemaster says Brown's vision was to give teenagers a skill they could turn into a career. Brown launched a new program several years ago called Camp Kickash. It's 2 weeks of intensive emergency response and fire training for kids across rural Alaska. Lemaster says the camps have been held in Aniak, Kotzebue, Galena, and at the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus.
And so it's not only an opportunity for them to get training in emergency medicine, but they also get a chance to be, they're away from home, they're living in a dorm environment, they're getting college credits, so giving them a little taste of what college would be like. And that's not so scary, it's not so impossible.
Gwendolyn Brock has watched Camp Kickash transform kids' lives, and she thinks it's a model that could work in other parts of the U.S., in inner cities as well as rural areas. With that in mind, she helped start the Pete Brown Foundation.
I've been trying to find a way to make sure that we don't forget who he was and what he did.
Brock knows it's going to take a lot of work, but she's sure Pete Brown's idea, so simple and powerful, can spread across the country.
Think about kids helping people in their community, taking a responsibility for the fact that I live here too. And I count, I matter, I can do something worthwhile, you know, and that's what it's all about. That's what it was all about for him.
So far, the Pete Brown Foundation only has about $2,000, but Gwendolyn Brock knows lots of people who want to donate. And she also knows a small start can lead to big things. That's one lesson Pete Brown taught everyone. In Aniak, I'm Annie Fite.
An ultra-endurance race has been proposed for the White Mountains north of Fairbanks. The plan calls for a 3-day event in which 50 racers bike, ski, or run over a 100-mile route on trails in the National Recreation Area. White Mountains 100 co-organizer Ed Plum says the event would provide a new venue for Alaska ultra sports athletes.
Currently, there's only one other 100-mile distance winter race in Alaska, and that's the Susitna 100, which is down near Anchorage. And the Susitna race is in February, but this would be a spring race when we've got a lot of daylight, snow conditions are nice, people tend to want to get out. And the White Mountain Trek Area is a great network of trails right in our backyard here in Fairbanks.
Plans call for the race to start Saturday, March 20th through Monday, the 22nd. Three public use cabins could be used for checkpoints. The Bureau of Land Management is taking public comment on a permit for the race. The agency has done an environmental assessment of the event and developed options for how it could be handled. BLM outdoor recreation planner Colin Cogley says the primary impacts would be on public recreation.
We've kind of built up a particular program, a particular expectation for folks going out there. Relative solitude and, you know, getting out an opportunity to natural experience and so forth. And a larger group like the race moving through, is that going to impact that experience or setting that we've sort of achieved through the years?
The BLM is taking public comment on the Ultra Race proposal through January 7th. The race roster is already full. A Lower 48 adventurer is planning an epic trek in Alaska and the Yukon. Andrew Skirka of Colorado, who has several long hiking and pack rafting trips under his belt, plans to embark on a 4,500-mile loop from Kotzebue in mid-March.
Full traverses of both the Alaska Range and the Brooks Range, and a pretty lengthy section down along the Lost Coast between Cordova and Juneau.
Skirka says the trip also includes a 1,000-mile wilderness stretch between Dawson City, Yukon, and Anaktuvik Pass. He plans to mix skiing and walking with floating rivers to complete the loop by next fall. Skirka says he understands the route and timeline are ambitious.
I'm walking into this trip with a great deal of humility and respect for the land of Alaska, and I've teamed up with really knowledgeable people like Roman Dial from Anchorage, and Aaron and Higg, and Tim Kelly, you know, people who really know their stuff, and they've been tremendously helpful.
Skirka introduced himself to the Alaskan backcountry last summer by solo trekking 800 miles from Hope to Cantwell, and then teaming up with two partners to win the 180-mile Alaska Mountain Wilderness Classic race. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. So if you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.